Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Ed Pulford, one of the hosts of the channel. On the podcast today, we have Kelly Hammond, who's assistant professor of East Asian history at the University of Arkansas. And she'll be talking about her new book, China's Muslims and Japan's Empire, Centering Islam in World War II, which was published this year, 2020, by University of North Carolina Press. The role played by minority groups in imperial projects is often a complex one, and perhaps particularly so in 20th century East Asia, where the expansion of the Japanese Empire occurred precisely as new discussions were emerging over the meaning of the nation itself and the place of cultural, linguistic, and religious identities within it. Japan's 1930s and 1940s acquisition of territories on the Asian mainland, and particularly in northeastern and northern China, entailed a host of encounters with new Muslim subjects, and as Kelly Hammond's book shows, their situation sheds new light on a wide range of less considered aspects of empire, identity, transnational connection, and world war in this region and beyond. Hammond demonstrates how, just as they were becoming the subject of both political and scholarly Japanese interest, Chinese Muslims were also deeply involved in debates over their place in an emerging post-dynastic China, as well as exploring other connections to Islamic groups elsewhere in Asia and the world. The Japanese, for their part, attempted to write Muslims in China and Southeast Asia into a wider story of Pan-Asian empire, while also navigating global alliances with fascist Italy and Nazi Germany. Throughout the book, Hammond deftly navigates the multi-layered transnational stories which centering Chinese Muslims brings into focus, balancing multi-perspectival consideration of intellectual and policy discussions in both Japan and across China, and perhaps most importantly, allowing for the voices of Chinese Muslims themselves to come to the fore. The experiences of these people caught between imperial spaces, the author shows, offer not only a reframing of a particularly febrile period of recent history, but also offer resonances which continued throughout the Cold War and even up to the present. But in this present, troubled as it is, I'll say welcome Kelly Hammond to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Ed. It's great to be here with you today.
Well, great to have you on to talk about this really fantastic book, which is so full of unexpected and I think, you know, to many people, completely new insights into this amazing story. But before we get into that, perhaps I'll begin by asking you something of your own academic background and how you came to be interested in the subjects that fill this book.
Yeah, I mean, the way that I sort of came to this project was a really organic one. And my first encounter with Muslims in China really came from my first time living in Shanghai. And I ended up living next to a mosque and regularly eating at a little Muslim restaurant that was across the street from the mosque. And I sort of started wondering a little bit more about Muslims in China. And those projects, you know, my intellectual curiosity about that sort of developed over time. And I ended up pursuing a PhD at Georgetown with James Millward, focusing specifically on the history of Islam in China. And when I started my PhD, he sort of presented me with an opportunity to either choose to learn Russian or to learn Japanese. And I went the Japanese route. So as I was starting to learn Japanese, I was kind of telling people about, you know, my interests. And one of the people I told this to was Jonathan Lippman. And he said, hold on a minute. I think I have some articles in my basement that have to do with, like, you know, the collaboration between, or sort of Japanese interest in Muslims during the Second World War. And he sent me this whole stack of articles that I painstakingly made my way through as I was learning Japanese. And that sort of planted the seeds for what would become this project and eventually become this book.
Right, so right.
That's kind of how started out with the getting there, I guess.
That makes sense, and I think makes for a pretty interesting early encounter with with Japanese language documents, for example. I mean, plenty of people might be doing Japanese or learning the language in order to read things of a more pop culture nature, perhaps. So I think delving into an obscure trove of documentation about interest in Chinese Muslims is a fitting baptism of some kind for this project. We'll get into talking, I think, more about, you know, how you sort of ended up writing about this group of people. And, you know, as we sort of get into the introduction of the book itself, perhaps I'll sort of ask just for you to define who the Chinese Muslims are that you discuss. I mean, you use a term Sino-Muslims. So do you want to give us a kind of picture of who they are and why it is that you chose that term?
Right. Well, you know, there are a number of different terms that we could use to talk about the people that I'm writing about in my book. But I specifically chose the term Sino-Muslim to indicate, firstly, that I am not talking about the sort of the Turkic minority or Turkic minority groups that live in Western China, such as the Kazakhs or the Uyghurs. I'm specifically talking and writing about a group of Muslims in China who for a long time have written in Chinese and are sort of considered to be ethnically more Chinese than the groups that live in further Western China. And so there's a little bit of contention about what this term means and why I specifically chose the term Sino-Muslims. Firstly, it has a sort of long, a developed intellectual pedigree, and people like Jonathan Lippman have used it for a while. And the reason that I chose it is because I did not want to use the officially designated category of the Chinese nation state of the PRC of Hui or Huizhou. Because I sort of wanted to talk about these people on their own terms and think about the ways that they were thinking and thinking about how they would fit into the place, their new place in the Chinese nation state, without the baggage of the current Chinese party state's term for these people who make up a sizable minority in the People's Republic of China.
Right. And I mean, it seems very relevant and a well-grounded decision. As far as that Huizhou term came about, I mean, actually, compared, I think, for the Uyghurs or other Muslim groups within China, it's not something that, not a group that has been written about quite so much, perhaps. I don't know if that's fair to say. You can contradict me. But where does that term come from in particular?
Well, I mean, it is an older term, and it has, you know, the Hui and the Huizhou have, you know, the Hui have been around for a long time, and that term is not a new one. But I just wanted to sort of disambiguate the terms that the party now uses to classify these people from some of the ways that I wanted to speak about them historically, because I think it gets so tangled up in the sort of current narratives of the place of Islam in China that I wanted to sort of give voice to these people and help them sort of maybe recover some of their history by allowing to sort of show that in the 1930s and 1940s, these ideas were fiercely debated and fiercely contested. And we shouldn't just sort of assume that there was like a sort of direct line from the 1930s to the present on how Islam is practiced and how people understood these terms in the past. So,
mm-hmm. Well, the book does a terrific job of kind of doing, I think, that disambiguation, both, you know, terminologically, but also the kind of complex narrative it weaves and the way it moves between so many different perspectives, as I mentioned in the intro there. I mean, as far as those kind of, or the main perspectives that we're interested in here are concerned, why were this group of people particularly important or interesting to, I guess, A, China as sort of new ideas of Chinese nationhood or statehood were emerging at this time, and then B, to the Japanese Empire, as you've mentioned already?
Yeah, I guess in terms of their importance or the way that the Chinese nationalists were thinking about minority groups in the 1930s and 1940s, you know, there was a very strong desire on the part of the Chinese nationalists to maintain the territorial integrity or to reassemble the territory of the fallen Qing Empire. And I think we all know that in order to do that, they needed to make appeals to peoples who lived in the peripheries, like the Tibetans, the Mongolians, and in my specific case, Muslims. And I think that, you know, they had a hard time trying to figure out how to incorporate these people into their vision for a Chinese nation state, that when a lot of the sort of ethno-nationalist rhetoric that was coming from the Chinese nationalists was very Han-centric and very centered on Han Chinese stories. So there was a sort of tension there. And I think that tension allowed a space for alternative voices and alternative spaces and alternative modes of support for, in my specific case, for Chinese Muslims, who were able to sort of look beyond some of the hollowness of the ethno-nationalist policies of the Chinese nationalists and look to other people for backing or support in some of the reforms that they hoped to implement within their own communities. So in some cases, it was the Soviets. In some cases, it was the Japanese. In some cases, it was the Chinese communists. But so there was just a space and an opportunity in that time to look to other, perhaps you could call them benefactors, to support reform ideas within their own communities.
Got it. Yeah, I mean, and you also do bring in the kind of importance of some of these, I guess, potential, you know, competing interests beyond just China and Japan in the book. And as we move on, though, to this question of Japan and Japan being the kind of particular center of focus on this community, how does that particular interest and the kind of Japanese focus on it that you gleaned from these documents dug out of the basement or wherever it was. That sounds very, very, very dismissive, but I only mean it as far as your own history is concerned. So the interest from the Japanese side in Chinese Muslims, how does that complicate or kind of add to our understanding of the Japanese imperial project in general?
Yeah, well, I think it does a number of things. Not only to complicate our understanding of the Japanese imperial project on the Chinese mainland, but to sort of complicate narratives of resistance that are sort of very prominent in the ways that the People's Republic of China presents people, collaborators and resistors during the war. So what I was really hoping to do was to very clearly and show that there was no unified Sino-Muslim resistance to the Japanese Empire during the Second World War. And that, in fact, a number of groups of Muslims found it to their benefit to work with and collaborate with the Japanese Empire. And I think that in a way, what this does is it gives us a new perspective on not only on the sort of temporal and spatial understanding of the Japanese Empire, but it presents us with an opportunity to sort of like, quote unquote, return the gaze. A lot of the work that's been done on the Japanese Empire follows people from the homelands or the home islands as they travel out into the colonies. And I think in my case, I'm showing, you know, people that are living under occupation and living within the boundaries of the Japanese Empire and beyond the boundaries of the Japanese, the greatest territorial extent of the Japanese Empire, and that showing their experiences traveling to the metropole and the ways that they understood Japanese imperial space. So I think I'm sort of adding another, it's not like a complete break, but I'm sort of adding another layer to some of the work that's being done recently on different types of peoples that inhabited the Japanese Empire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think the kind of distances that the book traverses and the kind of, yeah, weaving, I don't know, between sort of interstices of grander narratives that you might associate with particular blocks like Japanese Empire, like I guess China as a whole, but then also even beyond that to the Middle East and South Asia, Southeast Asia, and elsewhere. I think that is, you know, that is it's almost a yeah sort of narrative performance of that exercise in adding to our sense of where people fit and the greater complexity of who fell within some of these larger scale projects. But just also, I guess I'm curious to know more about the particular technicalities of getting to grips with all of this, because you do mention in your sort of introduction or your, I believe in a sort of preface that, you know, you're drawing on sources in five languages and across seven countries. So could you also just say a bit more about how the practical exercise of doing this research sort of developed?
Yeah. It's been obviously a long time in the making, and many different trips and many different trips to China, to Taiwan, to Tokyo, as well as trips to the National Archives in Washington, D.C., to Kew in outside of London, and just sort of piecing together my own personal archive of as many things that I could accumulate as possible having to do with this project. And, mm-hmm. you know, I was actually talking about this a couple of weeks ago. Some of it was just like strange luck. And I think that sometimes we underestimate, you know, the value and the importance of just going to libraries and trying out different types of search terms and just sort of like seeing what's out there. Because, you know, we don't have the old card catalogs. I remember going to Shanghai in 2002 and 2003 and sort of looking through the card catalogs for things that might be interesting to me. So, you know, that whole section on my book about tea was sort of just an accidental find that came out of some strange search that I must have done at the Diet Library. And it sent me down a couple week long rabbit hole on a trip in Tokyo to sort of dig up as many sources as I could regarding tea. So yeah, I think it's just been, I never really went into this project having, I sort of never really limited the type of research I did. Whenever I went on research trips, I just tried to accumulate as much stuff as I could so that when I came home, I could sort of try to piece things together and piece it all together. And I think in some ways that is, you know, very daunting because you come home with thousands of pages of stuff, but it's also, you know, allows for some of these stories to sort of be triangulated through different sources and allows for, you know, a variety of different narrative voices to come through in the book.
Mm. Well, and may also mean that you have your own sort of trove of documents to pass on to some future.
Right. If you feel like you need to learn Japanese, I might have some things for you.
Hook you up, yeah. That's really interesting to know, and I think you're absolutely right that it's an interesting kind of corollary of the notional convenience of digital access and obviously online catalogs and so on, that actually not being presented with what the available options are and just having to guess what the terms that might be most useful are It's a really interesting, almost counterintuitive dimension to that supposed convenience. But that's great. We'll jump into the actual book itself, and I guess, or the chapters of the book, we've basically already started. I guess conveniently enough, the kind of focus of the first chapter, which takes us from, I guess, Meiji Restoration in Japan through to colonization of the northeast of China with the Manchukuo state, looks at Japanese interest in, and particularly scholarly interest, I suppose, in Muslims in China during this period. So could you say something a bit more about that kind of greater interest in general in Muslims living in China, whether or not that was just part of a broader Japanese engagement with or intellectual engagement, you know, with lots of different sort of new horizons during this expansive period, or to what extent the question of Muslims in the growing empire was actually a political question too?
Yeah, I think so. In what I've sort of put together and pieced together was that this is part of a sort of growing intellectual exercise for intellectuals in the late Meiji era to sort of engage with these new categories of, you know, world, quote unquote, world religions. And so there was a sort of burgeoning interest in Islam, a scholarly interest in Islam, as Meiji diplomats began traveling to places like Persia and the Ottoman Empire. And then a number of Japanese officials began working in the service of the Ottoman Empire, I think sort of solidified the fact that in order to engage with or diplomatically engage with a number of these places, there needed to be a sort of understanding of who these people were and what Islam was. And this sort of, I think, really came together after the First Sino-Japanese War and the Russo-Japanese War, as more and more Japanese intellectuals or Japanese people were spending time on the Chinese mainland and coming in contact with these groups of people that I call Sino-Muslims. So there were a number of academic groups and sort of scholarly enterprises that researched Muslims and devoted their attention to understanding Islam and understanding Muslims. But as I explain in the chapter, the politicization and the imperial sort of outlook towards Muslims really sort of came together with the academic and scholarly interest after the establishment of Manchukuo in 1932. And that sort of meant that some of these academic branches then came under the auspices of the army or the navy. And, you know, there was a more sort of direct control over them after, especially 1932 and then again in 1937.
Well, I suppose one area in which the kind of elision of those political interests, but also, some new, I guess, academic theories specifically around, ethnicity and race and some of these things, which were such touchstones of Japanese projects on the Asian mainland in general, where that's expressed most clearly in some ways is this idea of Pan-Asianism. And I guess the notion that, you know, for all that it was an expanding empire in its own right, authorities in Tokyo would claim also to be a liberationist mission for Asia as a whole. So how did Muslims fit as far as the Japanese authorities or some of these scholars' thinking was concerned in this sort of Pan-Asianist vision?
Yeah, I think one of the great appeals of Pan-Asianism was its sort of intellectual flexibility. And Muslims by this time were very well aware of what was going on in the Soviet Union and to Muslims living under Soviet rule in Central Asia. And I think that there was a very strong anti-communist sentiment among Muslims, as well as it was sort of easy to appeal to these sort of anti-imperial and anti-Western sentiments that were also sort of circulating, not only among Muslims in the Middle East, but among Muslims in China and throughout Southeast Asia. So it's sort of, these overlaps of sort of pan-Islamism and pan-Asianism were quite easy to make for Japanese scholars of Islam, just because of the sort of flexibility of the idea of pan-Asianism. And they were really able to use it to appeal to Muslims, not only in North China, I think, but throughout the Southeast Asia and into other parts of the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I think that the kind of potentially countervailing, I guess, tendencies evident in very expansive ideas, as you're saying there, like pan-Islamism or pan-Asianism, almost reverse tendency at this time towards circumscribing and delineating and drawing national or ethnic boundaries. Like that kind of interplay is sort of there throughout the book. It's a very interesting, I guess, sub-theme of how, in general, the classificatory projects and very expansive projects sort of intersect here. As far as, though, Japan itself and the home islands, as you've already mentioned, was concerned, were there many Muslims living in Japan at this time? Or what kind of Muslim community, if any, was there in Japan, either prior to this period or sort of finding roots at this time?
Yeah, that's a great question. There were very few Japanese Muslims at this time. A number of people converted, there were a number of converts, but in terms of Muslims who were ethnically Japanese, there were very, very few of them. The majority of Muslims who were living on the home islands at this time were, there was a quite a large group of South Asian traders and living in Kobe and in Nagoya, and as well as a large group of Tatars, Volga Tatars, who had been naturalized by the Japanese government after they had fled Soviet persecution and fled the Bolsheviks and made their way across Siberia and eventually made their way to Tokyo. So they were regularly used in propaganda to show their sort of, number one, they were very valuable for showing Japanese Empire support of anti-communist and anti-Soviet policies. Sort of benevolence of taking these people in and, you know, naturalizing them as Japanese citizens, as well as for sort of showcasing to the world that the Japanese Empire, even though there were so few Muslims that lived in Japan, you know, was serious about supporting Islam and religious freedom on the home islands.
Mm. And I guess those sorts of narratives are easier to weave when you're not dealing with that many people, and you know, there can be a sort of showcase element, I guess, to the way that you purportedly treat a certain community for political purposes. But of course, things are so much more complicated when you then actually have to deal with a much larger number of people and all of the complications that building an empire involves, as it did in the Chinese case. So Chapter 2 takes us into the kind of negotiations that I guess multiple different sides were making or engaged in as the empire expanded throughout the 30s to encompass more of China. So you look at education, you've already hinted at this and the kind of idea of the reforms and the sort of, modernizing perhaps tendencies there in Sino-Muslim communities at this time. So how does education help us understand the place of Sino-Muslims at this point within China and the kind of decisions over belonging, identity, linguistic identity, and so on that they were navigating?
Yeah, so I think the main purpose, in my view, for this chapter is to show that Sino-Muslim communities, by the time that the Japanese and the Chinese nationalists got interested in sort of supporting them, already had very clear ideas of how they wanted to sort of engage with reform ideas that they were bringing back from maybe the Middle East, or how they thought about the changing role that education should play in their either decision to be a part of the Chinese nation state or to not be a part of the Chinese nation state. And I think that in a number of ways, what I was really trying to show was that they were actively engaged in negotiating with the, either the Chinese nationalists or the Japanese government about, you know, about how much buy-in essentially they would have into some of these projects, either by imperial building projects, either from the Chinese nationalist perspective or from the Japanese Empire's perspective. And so there were a lot of sort of contested debates, especially as I show in schools about, which languages that they would learn. And Muslims were always very clear that they were not willing to sort of sacrifice the Arabic component of their language learning in schools for either learning, you know, Chinese, the new Chinese national language, or learning Japanese. And so both the Japanese Empire and the Chinese nationalists had to often make concessions to individual communities in order to ensure that they could continue to learn Arabic in school rather than sort of replace those with either Japanese or Chinese.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So as you said, I guess, earlier on, I mean, this was a process of negotiation and a kind of, I don't know, consideration among members of this community around who would better guarantee, their ability to prioritize those things that they felt were most important, particularly in education, as you've said. Now, for those that did, elect to follow or to choose the Japanese side, if that's not too blunt a way of putting it, because as you said, or as you do explain, it wasn't always quite so binary. But for those that kind of tended towards a closer alignment with the Japanese, now you've alluded to the issues around, you know, collaboration and these questions of how contemporary concerns and the sort of PRC historical imagination casts people at this time. But I mean, how do you best see, or how do you see we should kind of extract ourselves from this binary of collaboration and resistance and so on? How do we understand these choices in a more nuanced fashion?
Yeah, that's another good question. I guess one of the things that I also was trying to make clear is that, you know, really until 1943, it was not clear that Japan was going to lose the war. And so getting a buy-in from people where it looked like, you know, after, you know, in the Japanese press and in public opinion until probably early 1943, it didn't look like Japan was going to lose. So hedging your bets with the Japanese Empire might not have seemed like a bad decision. It's only in retrospect and after Japan loses the war that this really becomes a problem for a lot of these people. So I think that that's an important consideration when we think about why people might have, jumped in bed with the Japanese Empire. Another sort of consideration that I think is important for us to keep in mind is that, you know, the some of these people were just looking for really interesting opportunities, and maybe their political allegiance to the Japanese Empire was not very strong. But if the Japanese Empire was willing to provide them with, you know, the opportunity to travel to Tokyo or the opportunity to go on a free Japanese-sponsored Hajj, it might have been useful, or, you know, they would have seen the value in that and taken these opportunities at the time. So whether or not people who collaborated or worked with the Japanese Empire fully bought into their empire-building projects is something that, you know, I would like to bring into question, but also understanding the sort of utility and the value of what Japan was providing, I think gives us, you know, most people would, you know, I've taken money from the Chinese Communist Party to study in Beijing for a year and a half. So, you know, it's a sort of similar situation, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, this is a sort of granular look at some of the everyday situations that are brought up as, you know, very grand scale type projects emerge. You know, I mean, perhaps on one level, the education policies and the ability perhaps to learn to learn Arabic or to go on a government-sponsored Hajj, as we'll come on to in a second, sort of plays into a vision of some of these grander Pan-Asian or Pan-Islam related ideas that we already mentioned. But on the other hand, you know, yeah, the opportunity for a better life and or a more interesting life is, of course, very compelling in the moment. And so, yeah, we'll kind of, I guess, move on to the next chapter where, again, some of these, multiple layers of issues come about, because one of the key sites that actually recurs throughout the book is the Tokyo Mosque, and this kind of, I guess, very obvious symbol and assertion of Japan's interest in Islam and kind of desire to portray itself or portray the empire as a friend of Muslims. So why was the Tokyo Mosque opened, and what kind of activities went on there? Because it seems that there was an awful lot of variety of visitors that it had.
Yeah, so the Tokyo Mosque was opened in May 1938. So sort of at this really, this interesting point in the trajectory of the war. It's after the Second Sino-Japanese War has started on the Chinese mainland, but obviously the Nazis have not yet invaded Poland. So there's this sort of tenseness in the world about what is going to happen. The would-be Axis powers are already aligned. And so, there's a sense of, there's definitely a sense of like you're either on the Axis side or the Allied side. And so at the opening of the mosque in May 1938, the guest of honor that was there was a man named Prince Hussein, and he was a son of Imam Yahya of Yemen. And the reason that he was there as the guest of honor was that he was actually, the Italian fascists actually had a very close relationship with Yemen and were supplying the Yemenis with arms and funds and army training to help resist the British on the Arabian Peninsula. So there's these sort of, the Axis alliance, what will become the Axis, the alliance between the Italian fascists and the Germans, the Nazis, and the Japanese sort of provides this interesting space for the movement and the traveling of Axis-aligned Muslims during this period. So, yeah, the opening of the mosque was really meant as a propaganda showpiece. And, all of these people are coming from all over Southeast Asia, as well as from China and the Middle East, to attend the opening of this mosque in Tokyo.
And were these visits kind of, I guess, it's quite ceremonial, short-term things? I mean, what other kinds of things were involved when these delegations and things came over?
Right. So that's the kind of interesting story here is that when these delegations would come to Tokyo, these Muslim delegations would firstly be taken to the Tokyo Mosque, but then they would sort of be given, the royal tour of the Japanese home islands, where they would visit places like the Meiji Shrine and the Yasukuni Shrine, as well as Ueno Park in Tokyo, military and naval academies. So it was really a way to sort of showcase, firstly, Japan's quote unquote benevolence towards the Muslim world, but also to showcase Japan's sort of imperial prowess, military prowess, and hopefully get some sort of buy-in from these countries and diplomatic engagement.
Yes, as a kind of, I guess, alternative pole for modernization and so on, which was, I guess part of the project in the more immediate East Asian vicinity. But as a later chapter explores, was part of this much broader imagining of, I think, what you call a sort of aspirational empire that went even beyond the East Asian sphere. But there was also, I guess, as well as this sort of inward, from the perspective of the Japanese home islands, trajectory, there was also considerable outward movement. And I think one of the most sort of, I don't know if swashbuckling would be the right term, but certainly one of the most engaging sort of stories in the book as a whole is the Hajj trip made by one Chinese Muslim figure, Tan Yichun. Could you say something about well, I guess firstly, indeed, how you came upon Tang's own account of his Hajj trip sponsored by the Japanese, and what happened along the way.
Tang's journal is actually published, and it was published in a number of magazines throughout the late 1930s and 1940s, and then it was published as a sort of bound volume. And I found a copy of it at the Beijing National Archive, the National Library in Beijing. So, you know, it's just this interesting source that sort of, I think it's a complicated source because Tang doesn't really take a side on where he stands. He's ambivalent about working for the Japanese, but he's also, you know, trying to create the sort of like apologia in some ways, because he did face a lot of criticism from nationalist supported Muslims for his for accepting Japanese money to go on this Hajj. And it's a sort of interesting story. His family had long, it was quite well known in Beijing, and he, you know, came from a pretty wealthy family. He did go to the opening of the Tokyo Mosque, and from what I can gather, it was during that trip that he was asked to organize this Hajj trip, where he recruited a number of Muslims back in Beijing. And, you know, they sort of faced all kinds of different obstacles. And, you know, the actual Hajj part of the journal is very short. It's really getting to Mecca and getting back from Mecca that present the sort of really interesting travel log of traveling on the brink of war in 1938, 1939.
Mm. Well, you mentioned that he was kind of aided along the way as well by this Axis connection and some connections using an Italian ship, I believe you say.
Yes.
From Hong Kong, is it, all the way across to the Gulf? And I mean, in addition to that, you discussed the nationalist response. You've mentioned it briefly there, but I mean, what was the kind of nationalist level of awareness of the fact that this was going on at the time?
Yeah, so I mean, in some ways, the amount of attention that the Chinese nationalists paid to this Hajj voyage was like free advertising for the Japanese Empire, because they were very, very concerned and very, you know, publishing all kinds of stuff about this Japanese-sponsored Hajj. They also, the group took an Italian ship, but because they were leaving, they left from Shanghai, they had to stop in all of these ports that were under British rule at the time. So they stopped in Hong Kong and Singapore and Colombo and in India before their final destination in Eritrea, which is under Italian control at the time. So they're concerned mostly about the British customs agents, but as they discover on their journey, the Chinese nationalists have a quite well-developed network of spies throughout the diaspora that seem to sort of come and encounter them on all of the places that they go. So in Singapore, they get picked up by some Chinese newspaper editors. And then when they finally get to Jeddah, it's made clear to them at immigration that there's already a delegation of Chinese Muslims in Mecca awaiting them. And though they had been sort of rallied up to be sent over from Al-Azhar, where they were studying in Egypt. So the Chinese nationalists sort of drew on the networks that they had to sort of try to cast these Japanese haji, or these Japanese sponsored hajis, as, you know, nefarious. But they were pretty involved in trying to intercept these men.
Yeah, I mean, it's extremely interesting, both on the kind of level of everyday encounters, with spies and intrigue and so on, but also, as you've mentioned there, really the kind of competing internationalism and the overlapping transnational networks that allow one set of people to be sending someone across the world and another set of people to be mobilizing people in those same locations that they know to keep an eye on them. So yeah, it's an extremely entertaining and also academically very fascinating part of the book. But as we move on, I mean, it's into this kind of broader space that much of the rest of the book, I guess, takes us, because this is where we come in chapter four to this idea of the aspirational empire, and indeed this the place of tea within this, which you've also already alluded to. So what is this kind of aspirational empire? I mean, you have this very intriguing map at the very beginning of the book as a whole, which includes, you know, sort of blobs of Eurasia highlighted to, you know, to a sort of part of that sort of imagination that, that takes us well beyond the greater East Asian prosperity, co-prosperity sphere and so on. So what was this and what was the place of tea within it?
Yeah, so I guess I have been thinking about this for a while, this idea that, you know, when I teach about the Japanese Empire, I always put up this, like, you know, this map that sort of shows this very bounded territory of, like, you know, the greatest territorial extent of the Japanese imperial project in, you know, by 1942. And in some ways, I just started to think of that map as very limiting, especially when I had this Japanese-sponsored Hajj and these men traveling, you know, all the way to Mecca. And so I started, you know, wondering about what the Japanese were thinking about with regards to Muslims and their imperial space. And it became quite clear to me that, you know, there were plans and there were ideas to sort of develop markets. And one of the places that they were hoping to do so was in places such as where there were predominantly Muslim populations. So part of their anti-colonial and anti-Soviet rhetoric, or anti-Western and anti-Soviet rhetoric, was trying to provide a space to create new types of consumers that perhaps lived in these places, in, you know, North Africa, South Asia, Central Asia, and to sort of develop these places as spaces, as sort of alternative spaces that could be used to create large markets that could then bolster the Japanese imperial presence in these places. And I think in some ways they were, you know, pretty successful at undermining certain types of markets. And I guess, you know, one of the things that I read Erica Rappaport's A Thirst for Empire about tea in the British Empire. And I'd just come across all these sources about tea, and it became quite clear to me that this was a sort of important part of this story as such a important global commodity in the first half of the 20th century.
And so the Japanese imperial project included the promotion of tea as a sort of Japanese cultural staple in addition to being a commodity, would you say?
I think that would be fair to say. They did also understand that, you know, a lot of Muslims already drink tea, so it could be something that they could, you know, sell tea from their own. Most of the tea that was being sold in these places actually came from part of their empire as well, came from Taiwan. And so I think it's important to sort of understand that there are sort of like different types of layers, and they were just trying to figure out consumer products that they produced within their empire that could potentially be exported to spaces where there were predominantly Muslim populations.
Right. And it's also a moment, I guess, where some of the lofty, whatever we think of them, sort of ideological ideas about trans-Asian connection and so on come down to the, I guess, grubbier business of capitalist imperialism and, you know, just selling stuff and making money. So I think it's a really valuable part of the picture that complements the, you know, the consideration you also give to religion or to pan-Asianism and the like. As far as this kind of broader reach of interest is concerned, of course, it also brought Japan's interest and Japanese thinkers' interest as it extended out westward into contact with what Japan's allies were doing in relation to Muslim populations elsewhere in the world. So how did Japanese thinkers and I guess political actors view Italian or German approaches to Muslim populations in their own imperial exploits during the war. And what's the particular importance of Afghanistan here, which you bring into the picture?
Okay. I think that is... So I hadn't understood how closely the Japanese were keeping an eye on what not only what the Nazis were doing with Muslims living, Muslims in the Balkans, but the Italians in North Africa, and they were keeping like a fairly close watch and analyzing quite carefully. Not only what the Nazis, but before them, the Germans and under Kaiser Wilhelm had done in the Middle East and in throughout the Balkans. So I think that there was definitely an awareness that this was something that all of three of the main Axis powers had to contend with, and trying to figure out how to quote unquote manage Muslims was something that they definitely looked to their Axis partners and how they were handling the situation. And I think where Afghanistan comes into the picture is, both the Nazis and the Japanese Empire were very interested in Afghanistan for a number of reasons, mostly because it was this sort of non-aligned party place during the Second World War, but because it's, sandwiched between the Soviet Union and the British India, it sort of provided a geopolitical space that they could sort of exploit in certain ways. And both of them, though, had very little connections, obviously, to Afghanistan. So in order to sort of legitimize their interest in the region, they both had to sort of create their own historical narratives that connected them to the region. And for the Japanese, it was actually to a pre-Muslim Buddhist past in Afghanistan. And for the Nazis, it was through the myth of the Aryan nation, the Aryans. So I think that they both managed to make connections to Afghanistan in different ways. It became really important, actually, the Japanese presence in Afghanistan became very important, especially after Operation Barbarossa, where the Soviets and the British essentially forced the Afghans to kick out the majority of the Nazis who were operating in Afghanistan at the time. So the Japanese networks on the ground in that region became really important for maintaining intelligence networks and understanding what was going on in the region.
Well, it's a fascinating kind of element, I guess, of a way of looking at the complexities of that region in general. I mean, I know you also have had some interest in Xinjiang in the past, and I guess the kind of layering of different historical influences or different traditions and peoples encountering one another in Central Asia. It's interesting there to see that such is the complexity of that region that both the Nazis and the Japanese were able to draw out elements that they liked from, or at least precursors or precedents for their own projects in that region. Quite in contrast to anything that may have been actually going on there, but sort of plumbing the depths of a kind of complex Silk Road past or something. In any case, though, that kind of brings us up more or less to where the book concludes, which is with some reflections on how things sort of played out in the ensuing decades, because as is very widely known, 1945, all of this came to a kind of clattering end with the demise of the Japanese Empire. But how did these kind of engagements and this very extensive and multi-layered sort of interest in the Muslim world and with Sino-Muslims in particular that you've documented play out and kind of live on in East Asia, in China, and elsewhere?
Yeah. I think the main sort of takeaway for that is that, Sino-Muslims, because of their ability to make connection, because of their sort of cultural capital as Muslims and their ability to make connections beyond the sort of Sino-sphere, were always sort of disproportionately valued in diplomatic engagement beyond East Asia. And so very quickly after the war, the Chinese, obviously the Chinese nationalists and the Chinese communists fell into a civil war. But I think after the establishment of the People's Republic of China, both the Chinese nationalists in exile in Taiwan and the new PRC government in the People's Republic of China sort of used what the Japanese had done as a sort of playbook. And one of the things that I'm trying to make, the points I'm trying to make here is that oftentimes we assume that the PRC nationality policy is sort of like directly imposed from the Soviet model. But I do think that there, in terms especially of direct policies on the ground, especially having to do with education, that both the Chinese communists and the Chinese nationalists were taking a sort of page out of the Japanese playbook in terms of their handling and dealing with minority populations.
Mm. Well, that's, I think, fascinating and particularly poignant thing to have documented, really, when we consider the place of Muslims and not necessarily particularly the Hui, or I should say not exclusively the Hui in contemporary China, but also, of course, Uyghurs in Xinjiang and some of the, you know, really grievous things that are going on there right in our present day. But Kelly, thank you so much for all of your time. You've kind of done an amazing job, I think, of giving us a sense of what's in this book. And I have to add that there's an awful lot we didn't get to, which should encourage all of you listeners to rush out and buy it immediately. Well, maybe stay in and order it. Maybe that's more appropriate. But anyway, thank you very much for speaking to us, Kelly. But perhaps before you go, you could tell us something about what you're currently working on and what's carried you beyond this book.
Okay, yeah, sure. Just very quickly, I'm sort of bringing this book into the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And so my new project is called Islam and Politics in the East Asian Cold War, where I'm going to look at the way that the nationalist government in exile in Taiwan, as well as the new Chinese government on the Chinese mainland, and hopefully the post-occupation government in Japan, all sort of continued to mediate their relationships, especially with new post-colonial Muslim nation states throughout the 1950s, 60s, and probably up to the early 1970s. So,
yeah, well,
you can wait fantastic. Another 10 years for that one, though.
I'll be. Hopefully, I'll have left the house by then. I'll come back in order to record another podcast, of course. In any case, Kelly, in the meantime, thank you so much again for appearing today. It was really great having
you. Thanks, Ed. It's always great to talk to you.
Listeners, too, it's great to talk to you as well, although you're less responsive than interviewees are. But thank you for listening anyway to New Books in East Asian Studies. It's a podcast on the New Books Network, and it'll be back with you again very soon. Goodbye.